Welcome to the Spring 2017 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. My name is Dan Shustak, your host for this Spring Seminar Series. This annual lecture series is funded by MCLA's Academic Affairs, the Environmental Studies Department, and donors to the MCLA Foundation. Each spring semester, we invite a series of experts to campus to present on various aspects of sustainability and the environment. This semester, our series topic is the science and management of invasive species. Over the course of the semester, we will welcome to MCLA various experts from state and federal agencies, academia, nonprofits, and private industry. Each week, our guest speaker will delve into their area of expertise related to the research and management of invasive species in our state, region, as well as globally. Information and links to audio and video recordings of tonight's lectures will be posted at mcla.edu/greenliving. Tonight's presentation will last around 45 minutes, and then we'll have 10 to 15 minutes for questions and answers. Tonight's speaker is Jesse Hoffman. Jesse is the preserve manager and botanist at the Albany Pine Bush Preserve in Albany, New York. Jesse has a bachelor's degree in natural resources from Cornell University, where he focused on applied ecology. He is a lifelong botanist and is in charge of much of the on-the-ground conservation and recreation work at the Albany Pine Bush. Jesse supervises seasonal staff and coordinates several groups of long and short-term volunteers who help him in ensuring that the trail system is maintained, boundaries are posted, native seed is collected, invasive species are located and eradicated, and habitat is restored throughout the Pine Bush. Please help me welcome Jesse to MCLA.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to be here, excited to tell you a little bit about what I do at the preserve and kind of explain a little bit about, we'll start out by explaining just a little background on the Albany Pine Bush. First of all, has anybody been to the Albany Pine Bush? Is anyone familiar with it? Okay, a couple of people. Okay, awesome. So talk a little bit about what makes it special, and then I'll go ahead and get into kind of the management that we do on the ground. And it's a little broader than just invasive species, but I think it'll be interesting. So first of all, the Albany Pine Bush Preserve exists to preserve this globally rare ecosystem composed of pitch pine and scrub oak. Those are kind of the bedrock plants. It's an inland pitch pine scrub oak ecosystem, 3,300 acres. And these are kind of pictures of the overall kind of gestalt. When you're out there and you're looking at it, this is like what a pine barrens looks like. The ecosystem is based on deep sandy soils that were deposited here, they were deposited there when Glacial Lake Albany covered basically the entire Hudson Valley. And where the Mohawk River flowed in, there's this sandy delta, which correlates with this area here. And you can see that the pine bush, which is this thin red line here, is situated directly on those deep sandy soils. So historically, this type of habitat would have existed throughout this area on these deep sandy soils, but there are only small remnant patches left, one of which is the areas that are protected by the preserve. The sandy soils that were deposited were then blown and shaped into dunes. I think this is a really neat image of one of our areas in the preserve. It's a 2-foot contour interval, and you can really see those parabolic dune shapes. So we've got prevailing westerly winds, and they've shaped the dunes into these kind of parabolic structures, which recently the preserve was recognized as a national natural landmark, largely as a result of that sand dune kind of formation. When you go out there, you don't necessarily think you're looking at sand dunes because everything's vegetated. So I tried to find some pictures where, like, you can see the sand. And, you know, areas of trailside disturbance or where there's a little erosion happening, or certainly where we're doing major restoration projects, you really can walk out there and you're in this, like, this landscape that's like pure sand. But when you're out there on the ground, it doesn't necessarily feel like sand dunes. But really the fact that there's some topography, and we're not talking about, you know, thousands of feet of elevation differences, but our highest dunes are maybe 70 feet, but even just, and most of them are much lower than that, 20, 30 feet. But even that slight amount of difference in topography adds all these really interesting microclimates to the landscape. So you've got north slopes and south slopes, and you've got areas that are shaded more. You've got areas where cold air drains down in pools. And that's all as a result of kind of the geologic base of what we have here. And then the other thing that is, of course, important about sand is that, first of all, it's really well drained. So anything that wants to live here needs to be adapted to drought conditions much of the time. And sandy soils are also not very nutrient rich. So things that are able to grow here need to be able to deal with that secondary stressor also. On top of all that, the second like major ecosystem driver is that this is an early successional ecosystem. It needs disturbance in order to thrive. And historically, that would have been accomplished through wildfire. We try to maintain that as much as we can. We do a lot of burning in the preserve. We shoot for 200 plus acres a year. And most years we're able to hit that. Last year we had kind of a bad year because weather and all kinds of other factors. But that's kind of like the third whammy as far as plants and things that are adapted to this ecosystem. So you've got really dry soils, you've got really nutrient poor soils, and you've got the fact that on a 10 to 15 year basis, everything's getting burned up. So it's really a fairly extreme place for a plant to live. And it's because of that, the plants that tend to thrive here are pretty unique. This is what it looks like right after a burn. But within a couple of weeks, everything's greened up. The plants are bouncing back. So the plants have adaptations to deal with this. Pitch pine trees that are long-lived have got thick, corky bark, so they don't get hot enough to top kill. Lots of other things are adapted by having these massive root systems, and that helps with basically all of the stressors. So big, deep tap roots help you get water when there's not a lot of water near the surface, and it also helps the plant to be able to resprout readily because it can store a lot of energy underground. And that's typically what we find. You'll go in and it looks like this on day one. This is like by 3 or 4 weeks later, it's already, everything's really bouncing back quite easily. So just to go through kind of the main plant components that comprise the ecosystem, the overstory is dominated by pitch pine trees. They're kind of these really interesting, wacky looking trees that have this kind of amorphous structure. They've got thick, corky bark, like I mentioned, and the other adaptation they have is that they are able to epicormically bud. So they have these buds that lie dormant under the bark all along the branches and along the main stem. And if something happens, like a fire gets up into here and zaps this whole thing, these buds will break and it'll just start putting out new branches. That's not very common in tree species. Usually if the main trunk of the tree does not have the ability to do that anymore. It's just the growing tips. But on a pitch pine, it can basically put out branches and needles anywhere at any time. So that's the main component in the tree layer. You can see there's a pretty well-developed shrub layer here, and that's primarily composed of two species of scrub oaks, Quercus ilicifolia and Quercus prinoides. These are multi-stem shrubby oak trees. They can get about 30 feet tall if left unchecked, but because, like I mentioned, this is an early successional ecosystem, they're usually getting killed back before they're able to get that big. So they typically run anywhere between, 3 to 10 feet tall in the preserve in a general sense. And then you can see there's lots of kind of interstitial space here where there's all kinds of grasses and forbs growing. We've got lots of prairie grasses, Indian grass, and big blue stem. And little blue stem are kind of the dominant species. And then there's a whole variety of different forbs. This is wild blue lupin, New Jersey tea, horse mint, and bush clover. Lots of fabaceous plants tend to like the preserve, and I think that that's because they're well adapted, again, to the nutrient-poor soil. So there are species that have a relationship with bacteria in their roots that allow them to fix atmospheric nitrogen, so they basically can self-fertilize. So they do really well in these kind of nutrient-poor soils. New Jersey tea is another one that has a similar relationship. It's not a fabaceous plant, but it does have a relationship with bacteria in the soil. The preserve hosts 69 species of greatest conservation need, which is a New York State designation for wildlife species that are rare, threatened, or declining throughout the state. They span all different taxonomic groups. This is just kind of a smattering of them. We've got eastern hognose snake, eastern spadefoot toad, spotted turtle, red-headed woodpecker, prairie warbler, brown thrasher, frosted elfin, inland pine barrens buck moth, and our most famous critter in the preserve, this is the federally endangered Karner blue butterfly, which we have healthy populations in the preserve. Like I mentioned, it's globally rare. There are only about 20 ecosystems that are similar throughout the entire world, and the Albany pine bush is widely regarded as one of the best remaining examples of an inland pitch pine scrub oak barrens ecosystem. So hopefully I've impressed upon you the importance of the ecosystem and the reason that we're restoring land and working so hard to maintain this is because of all the things that I talked about. The rare plants, the rare wildlife, the fact that it's globally imperiled. And of course, this ecosystem, like many, is threatened. So first of all, it's threatened by development. This is a map of preserved lands in the green color. You can see that the New York State Thruway bisects the preserve. Lots of homes, businesses, development all over the place. So it's in this ever-shrinking landscape, and we're always trying to buy property when it is available to be bought. But you can see there's not much left. You know, there's a couple of bigger parcel areas, but a lot of it's already developed, and it's kind of already gone. So that piece, we do what we can, but we don't have a ton of control over. And then habitat degradation is the other one. And you can see the picture here. We've got lots of nasty things that come in. And that's really going to kind of be the focus of the talk here. So I break habitat degradation down into two different parts. The first one is invasive species, which you guys have presumably got some background in now and have learned quite a bit about. And then the other one that's a little bit more unique to the Albany pine bush is this idea of overabundant native species. So I'm going to spend some time talking about that first. Because the Albany pine bush is an early successional ecosystem, if you take out the disturbance, the ecosystem will succeed, will continue to undergo succession until eventually, if you did nothing, it would become some kind of a more typical northern hardwood deciduous mixed forest. That's a really common, really common throughout New York State, really common throughout the Northeast, kind of nothing special. And ecological generalist species, like the ones listed here, white pine, aspens, cottonwood, red maple, those are things that you're going to find kind of like all over the place. They're not species that would be able to deal with the levels of disturbance required to maintain a pitch pine scrub oak barrens. But we've done things like excluded fire for 40 years and abandoned the landscape, essentially. And when you do that, these things do start to come in and get a foothold. And it becomes this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, because once these things are on the landscape, they create a lot more shade, and they shade out the flammable species that are adapted to the periodic disturbance. So it basically makes the environment unsuitable to be burned, which is the disturbance that would maintain the ecosystem. So we have a lot of area where these things have come in and become massively, massively overabundant, essentially, for the ecosystem that we're talking about. They're native species, but we're treating them like they're invasive because they are invading the particular landscape and habitat and ecosystem that we're tasked with protecting. So the goal for these species is essentially to eradicate them from the upland communities. So things like red maples and aspens and white pine are things that would all exist in wetter areas of the preserve, areas that historically would not have burned as often or as well. So we're not trying to get rid of them totally from the landscape, but we want them out of the prime areas that are restorable to pitch pine scrub oak barrens. White pine, you see here, it's a common eastern forest tree, not fire adapted at all. If you run fire through seedlings or even pole-sized trees up to like maybe about a 4-inch diameter, they totally get top-killed. And these don't resprout from the roots at all, so Once the above ground portion has died, that's it. They're out of the picture. It's a really heavy cedar though, and it's able to, because it's such a heavy cedar, it's able to form these dense stands, of white pine forest. So what we do, this is kind of a picture of what the white pine forest looked like. This is an easy one for us to eliminate. We just contract out with logging companies to come in and clear cut the stands. They use big giant machines that look like this. This is called a Feller Buncher. And they go in with traditional logging equipment, traditional logging practices, and they cut all the white pine, and we make sure that we leave any residual pitch pine. Sometimes there will be these spindly pitch pines that kind of hang out. They must have already been big enough when these got started, and they'll persist in the canopy. But essentially, once you clear cut this, it's good to go. You don't have to worry about the white pines coming back. Unfortunately, if you look at the level of light on the ground here, this stuff is really dense, and it tends to shade out any of the pine barren species that historically would have been there. All of the species that thrive in the pine barrens are species that are adapted to high light. They need high light levels. You saw that canopy in the pictures I was showing. You know, the trees are really widely spaced. So they're very shade intolerant. And when you've got shade this dense for as long as these forests have been here, there's essentially nothing in the understory that would be reminiscent of a pine barrens anymore. So we go back and we replant the understory. And this is kind of our after picture. All the white pine that was in here has been eliminated. There are residual pitch pine trees in the overstory. And the understory now is a mix of wildflowers, grasses and forbs, including wild blue lupin, which is the host plant for the Karner blue butterflies. So we've gone from a habitat that was common throughout the Northeast, not something that's hosting any of our species of conservation need, not hosting Karner blue butterflies. We've opened it up, brought back a functional landscape, and it's, while this is not quite a pine barrens, this is kind of where things can stay for a while. This is like the holding pattern until we can get in there and either try to plant the woody species back in, like the scrub oaks, or just given enough time, those things will move in on their own from adjacent habitat that's still pretty intact. That's white pine. Aspen and cottonwoods are a little bit of a different ball game. These are also widespread throughout the U.S. Aspen, I think, is the most widespread tree globally, actually. I think quaking aspen gets that designation. The understory in dense stands of aspen tends to be a little bit more intact because the nature of being in one of these aspen stands is the light is very dappled, so it's not quite as deep and dark. So a lot of times the pine barrens vegetation underneath an aspen stand is suppressed, but it's not gone yet. So that's kind of one thing that we have going for us. The thing that we have working against us is that aspens in particular are a clonal species. So what you see here when you look at this looks like many different trees, but these are all connected underground. It's one big organism in reality. And what that means is it's much harder to kill these things. If you go in there and just try to cut them down, they resprout like a million times and you end up with this, which we call a dog hair thicket, which is kind of like a nightmare mess that we abandon for 20 years until we can deal with it again once the trees are bigger. Much more tenacious of a plant. So there are two techniques that we use to eliminate aspen trees. The first is a mechanical technique called girdling. When you're girdling, you basically use a tool to remove a strip of bark all the way around the circumference of the tree. And what that does is it disrupts the phloem layer. So the xylem brings nutrients and water up to the leaves. The phloem brings the nutrients back down to the roots. So by disrupting the phloem layer, you're allowing the tree to keep pushing nutrients and water up, but it can never replenish its energy reserves in the roots. So when you do that, it causes the tree to exhaust all of its resources, and it doesn't ever have that, it doesn't elicit that resprouting response. So this is a technique that's really effective. It takes several years for a tree to die when you girdle it. It'll continue to leaf out like normal, depending on the size of the tree, for at least a year. Sometimes up to 3 or 4 or 5 years if you have real big ones. So it's a really effective technique. You can only do it in the spring when the sap is flowing readily. Otherwise, it's not practical to be able to peel the bark off. The bark peels off really well in the spring. By summer, you can't really do it anymore. And this is something that we are able to involve the community in. So we have a relationship with a local middle school. They send out 100 seventh graders every year, and we give them all these big sharp tools and they go out there and hack trees and peel bark and they have the time of their lives. It's super labor intensive, hard to do this at scale. So this is one kind of tool in our toolbox. And then the other one is to use chemical control. So the technique that we use for this and many of the woody species in the preserve is called drill and fill. So you're drilling 1-inch diameter holes every 8 inches around the circumference of the tree, and then you fill those holes with glyphosate herbicide. This is a technique that complements girdling well, because girdling you can do in the spring. This you have to wait until late summer to fall. You want the tree to be drawing down into its roots, so it draws the herbicide down and kills the root system. This is much, much faster. So it took us about 20 years to clear 100 acres using only girdling. Then we did like about 1,100 acres in 2 years using the chemical technique. So when we got to a point where we were ready to like really ramp it up, then we started using this chemical control technique. Either way, whether you're doing girdling or using chemical control, this is kind of what the end result is. So you can see lots of scrub oak and things bouncing right back in this understory. By killing killing the aspen trees, you've released the light competition. These will eventually rot and fall down on their own. We don't have to worry about doing anything with that. And then the understory is able to thrive, and it bounces right back to being Pine Barrens habitat. Red maple is our most recent plant that we've been going after. Similarly to the aspen, it doesn't tend to totally outcompete everything in the understory. It just suppresses. And I think part of that is because we don't have massive stands of red maple. It's kind of in little clusters here and there. So I think there's enough light able to kind of get in from the sides that it doesn't kill these things totally outright. We decided to see if we could maybe just control this with fire alone. So we ran some fire through red maple. And what happened was it top killed it, but it didn't kill the roots. So you end up with this massive resprouting. There was some literature that indicated that maybe you can kill it with fire. So we decided to try that first. It was like a total failure bust. Made a big fat mess. Now we're going to have to like deal with all these multi-stemmed, like massive organisms at some point in the future. So that didn't work. So we moved on to, you can't really girdle at red maple. So we moved right on to that same drill and fill technique. So we did quite a bit of this past fall, and this spring we're kind of waiting to see the results. But presumably it should work just the same way that the aspen did. It'll kill the overstory, and then the understory will bounce back. So those are the ecological generalist species. We also do some work with trying to tweak the amounts of the pine barren specialists. So pitch pine and scrub oak are integral to the ecosystem, but we're out there trying to do some work in tweaking those as well. And most of this comes out of trying to answer the question of what does a healthy pine barrens look like? Because this is this globally rare fire-dependent ecosystem, we can't just go somewhere else and say like, oh, like, well, what does it look like over there? There is no over there to go to. Because we're like the best example of it, we're like kind of the model. So we did extensive literature reviews, going back into historical data, to try to figure out what exactly, you know, this ecosystem looked like before it was abandoned, before the ecosystem processes shut down because of fragmentation and then were abandoned through fire suppression, essentially. And what we found was that there are three main plant communities that comprise the overall ecosystem. There's pitch pine scrub oak barrens, which has a 20 to 60% tree cover and a 20 to 60% shrub cover. This is the rarest of the plant communities, and it's the one that supports the majority of the species of greatest conservation need, including the Karner blues. There are also pitch pine scrub oak thickets, which have a similar tree cover, 20 to 60%, but much higher density of scrub oak, so 60 to 100% shrub cover. This is useful for some species, things like prairie warblers, shrubland birds love this stuff. Should be a natural component of this. Essentially, if you don't burn this very often, you end up with this. This is like kind of the next successional stage. And then there's also pitch pine scrub oak forests, where we've got much denser tree cover, greater than 60% tree cover. And if you don't do anything with this, it succeeds into this. And then if you don't do anything with this, it succeeds into all of those other kind of ecological general species that we were talking about. The forests also are an important part of the ecosystem, but not supporting the levels of rare wildlife and things that the barrens are. So what our analysis showed us was that we should be shooting for something like this, where we've got 70% pitch pine scrub oak barrens and thicket, and about 30% pitch pine scrub oak forest. What we have on the landscape right now is more like this. We've only got about 40% pitch pine scrub oak barrens and thicket, and 60% forest. So we need to thin out some of that pitch pine forest. And the nice thing is, this is like really intact ecosystem. The only thing that changes, that separates this from a barrens is the fact that it's got, you know, a higher density of pitch pine trees. So if we go into this landscape and remove some of the pitch pine trees, the restoration is done. So this is kind of a neat visual that somebody put together. This is showing the density of trees typical in a pine barrens, and this is the density of trees more typical in a pitch pine scrub forest. So what we did is we, on this parcel in particular, we went out and we had the site cruised, like a timber cruising, and they marked all of the leave trees instead of the take trees, because we were leaving. The ideal number is about 20 trees per acre. We shoot a little high because when you have these forest-grown trees and then you remove a bunch of them, a lot more of them end up snapping off, so they can't deal with the wind load and things like that. So anyway, 30 trees per acre is what they marked. And then we put it out to bid and do a timber contract. We try to do this kind of work in the winter, particularly in our really nice habitat, because if the ground's frozen, you're causing that much less, you know, rutting things up, and like doing irreparable harm to the plants, that you're driving all over. This is what it looks like immediately afterwards. So you can see that's quite a difference from that dense forest. We really opened it up. Everything's kind of crushed down because the growing season hasn't started yet. And this is what it looks like by the end of the growing season. So you can see the shrub layer bouncing right back. You can see lots of grasses here. This is actually the part of the header, the landing where they brought all the logs out. So this needs some additional work. But the background back here is really bouncing back pretty nicely. And the response has been, we did kind of a trial 1 year, responded really well, and we've got about 80 acres of this happening right now. They're just about finishing up. Scrub oak is another one. I talked about that thicket versus barrens kind of difference. It was really hard to tease out in the literature the difference between barrens and thicket and how much of one there should be versus the other. And we're still kind of grappling with that as a staff internally, because we don't have a model and we've tried to do research and there's no clear answer. Some of this comes down to, you know, we are the experts. We're trying to like hash it out between each other and figure out what the proportions of this, should be, thicket versus barrens. But we do know that certainly barrens support Karner blues and, you know, helping to recover this endangered species is something that's high on our priority list. So we certainly want to be erring on the side of barrens versus thickets. In order to do that, again, the ecosystem's pretty intact. It's just got too much scrub oak at this point. So we need to eliminate some of the scrub oak. Scrub oak's a really tenacious plant. It's got those massive root reserves. There's no way to deal with it mechanically. So, we're reliant on a chemical technique. The first thing we do is go in with this massive machine called a Hydroax and mow it all down, because when it's up over your head, there's no way you can do anything with it. So the first step is mowing it down. This is what it looks like out there after it's been mowed. Ta-da! And then you let it green up. And it grows back. This is that same growing season in the spring. It pushes out new growth. And at that point, you can go out and do a foliar treatment. You're not spraying herbicide way over your head. The idea is we want to be really targeted here, because the stuff that's in between the scrub oak is what we're focusing on. We want that to flourish. So if we go out there and kind of nuke the whole site, it becomes a disaster, and it is the opposite of what we want to do. So by doing the mowing and treating the plants when they're really small, it enables us to be much more targeted. This is what it looks like immediately after. This is during year one. So you can see there is a little bit of overspray. There always is going to be that. Herbicide's really powerful stuff. If one or two droplets land on adjacent foliage, those plants are going to die also. And that's what you see here. This is the end of year two. You can see, if you're botanically inclined, you can see lots of mullein in here. Those are kind of the pioneer species that come into waste places. They're like the first things in. They come up, they do their thing, dump a ton of seed, and then they are dormant till the next major disturbance. And then this is by the end of year three. And this is really healthy-looking barrens. You can see we've got lots of good grass, lots of good area for wild blue lupin, intermixed with scrub oak. So this is kind of the success of what we're going for. So again, that's kind of the before. You've got this monoculture of scrub oak, no room for carners, and then this is kind of the after. All right, so that's kind of overabundant species. Now I'm going to move on to straight invasive species, the ones that you guys probably have been talking a lot about. And I first just wanted to go through quickly like our methodology here. So any organization that's dealing with invasive species has to come up with a way to prioritize limited time, energy, resources. And this is what we've kind of settled on. Our first priority is early detection, rapid response. You've probably heard that term a million times if you have professionals coming in and talking about their invasive species work. It's easiest to get rid of stuff when it's not there yet. So either when it's not there at all, something new coming into the preserve, or things that are not well established preserve-wide yet. So we have a list of things that might be common outside of the preserve, but they're not common where we are, where we're working, and those are things that we're focusing on primarily, trying to get rid of them anywhere we see them, no matter what. And then we're also, of course, anytime we see something new, that we want to deal with that right away. The second priority is invasive species prevention zones. You guys talked about this at all? ISPZs? Is that a term you've heard? No, not really. Okay. So this is the idea that if you've got an area that doesn't have a lot of invasives in it, you should keep the invasives out of that spot. So we've identified kind of prime habitat areas where the invasive species, we've already done invasive species work, we've eliminated the bulk of them, and these are areas that are, we just need to get in there and check and make sure that things aren't coming back in. So that's kind of, it's similar to early detection rapid response in that when you've got, you know, before an infestation becomes a huge issue, if you can nip it in the bud, you've saved yourself that much time and energy. So invasive species prevention zones is number two. Number three is rare species locations. This primarily has to do with carners in the preserve. Anything that's threatening carner population or an area where we need to expand potential carner habitat, that's kind of our another major priority for us. And then beyond that, we've kind of got this matrix here. So these are our top three. Once we've done all of this, then we're into this matrix. And it's on this axis, we've got basically going from our highest quality barrens, low quality barrens, down to other preserve plant communities, and then small infestations and large infestations. So our top priority, once we're outside of these, is going to be high quality barrens with small infestations. And then you follow it down to our last priority would be other preserve communities with large infestations. And this is how we've chosen to allocate our efforts. The early detection rapid response species that we have in the preserve are the ones that you see listed here. We've got autumn olive, barberry, buckthorn, burning bush, Norway maple, and white mulberry, in addition to obviously anything new to the preserve. Actually, I have to add stiltgrass to this, which we just found in the preserve, which is a bad one. I'm disappointed about that, but. And then kind of our more common invasive species, the one that we're seeing all the time out there, black locust, Japanese knotweed, multiflora rose, oriental bittersweet, scotch pine, the shrub honeysuckles, Siberian elm, and tree of heaven. A lot of what we're doing is small infestations because, like I mentioned, the early detection rapid response stuff and the invasive species prevention zone, those are areas that are not super heavily invaded yet. So we're typically going through intact habitat and doing a lot of survey work. It's almost more survey than it is treatment at that stage. When we do find them, we've got a black locust sprout popping up here in one of our former restoration sites. We're usually just hand-cutting these with loppers, spraying a little bit of herbicide on the stump, and that's all it takes to get rid of these things. If we get into a bigger patch, we'll use brush cutter sometimes to do the cutting part, but we're still just hand spraying this technique we call clip and drip. When we get into the rare species protection, so things like protecting corner habitat and expanding corner habitat, then we're into much more significant quantities, much more significant kind of footprint on the landscape. So I want to talk about black locust. Black locust is the invasive species we've focused the most effort on and have been working on the longest in the preserve. Long before we dealt with any of those other whole list of species, we were working on black locust. Black locust is another species that's clonal. This is what it looks like inside of a black locust clone. So you've got black locust trees, almost 100% black locust, and then the understory is typically other invasive species like shrub honeysuckles and garlic mustard, or it's in this picture it's a lot of rubus species, so blackberries and raspberries and brambles and things that are really, really, really common. This is when you have a landscape that's that degraded, you basically have to start over. So the first step is to eliminate the trees. So we're going in, having these sites logged. They pull out all the logs using skidders and feller bunchers and major destructive equipment. They pull out all of the stumps and dig these deep, 20-foot deep pits and put all the stumps in deep enough so that they can't resprout and they can't make it back to the surface. And then we go in and we have to replant. So because the understory is so degraded, there's no seed bank left there. When we go in and do all of this work, we've got to put something on the landscape. So we're putting a bunch of different grasses and forbs in and basically creating these native prairie habitats. And this has been really successful in boosting carter numbers because we can load these sites with wild blue lupin. And while it's not barrens that we're creating, it's again, it's that holding pattern. At some point in the future, we can go back in, put the woodies in, and end up with something that's more like a barrens. But in the meanwhile, we've taken, this is kind of just a little zoomed out, and you can see there's a couple of pitch pines hanging on inside the black locust clones also. But you can see the kind of the before and after. You've got this highly degraded ecosystem composed mostly of non-native species, serving no function at all as far as carters or any of the other species of greatest conservation need go. And what we've created is this native prairie that's primarily composed of native species, and it's really, really super functional as far as particularly carters are concerned. This work has allowed our carter blue populations to really explode in the preserves. I started in 2008, right here, like near the low point. We predicted that there were less than 1,000 butterflies left in the preserve at that point. We did all of this black locust work where we're clearing totally non-functional habitat, putting in prime carner habitat, and the numbers have really exploded. So this dotted line here, 3,000 butterflies, anything above that, the carner is considered recovered in our population. Not federally recovered, but recovered within the Albany pine bush subpopulation. And we have been above that now for the last, since 2013. Last year was similarly encouraging. And the numbers really like took off, and it's been really an exciting time, I think, to be at the preserve, to have all of this new habitat. You can see, the survey area has obviously increased a lot, and that's because there's more habitat to survey, and the butterflies have responded. It's been a really exciting time at the preserve. So in order to do that kind of broad-scale restoration, where we're removing everything, we've got to be putting stuff back, like I talked about. And that requires a lot of seed. So the vast majority of the seed that we use in the preserve is hand-collected from preserve lands. And we do that with staff, seasonal employees, volunteers, and temporary help. And the reason that we are having to hand collect most of our seed is that we're committed to using only our local ecotype seed.
So we only use, we've set a 50-mile radius from the preserve, so the genetics of the seed that we are using needs to be collected within that footprint to preserve our, essentially preserve our ecotype. So we're using local ecotype seed, which is typically not available, and even if it were available, the species that we're collecting are not typically available in large quantities, and if they are, they're really expensive to buy. We do have a really good relationship with Ernst Conservation Seeds, who are kind of a powerhouse in the seed industry as far as native seed species go. We allowed them to come to the preserve and do a lot of collecting many years ago. So they are actually growing our ecotypes off-site, but the plants are genetically our plants, which then they sell to, to whoever needs seed. But they've been really generous in donating a lot of seed back to us. So I don't have to collect every species that I need because I can get some of it from them. Particularly little blue stem seed, they always donate. They always ask me how much I need and they'll send it out to me for free each year. This is great. This is the suite of species that we collect seed for. Little blue stem is not on here because we get that from Ernst, like I mentioned. Wild blue lupin, this is obviously like one that we spend a lot of time and effort trying to collect. There's a direct correlation between the amount of wild blue lupin we put out there on the landscape and the landscape's capacity for carners. So we expend an enormous amount of time and effort collecting that. The other species are typically species that are good nectar species for carners, or they provide structure in the landscape, kind of at a micro scale. So we have tick trefoil, goat's rue, butterfly, milkweed, dogbane, horse mint, New Jersey tea, big blue stem grass, Indian grass, bush clover, and our two scrub oak species. So how is this accomplished? Like, you're literally just going out there when the seed is ripe and breaking off seed pods and throwing them into a bag. It's not super glamorous work, but it's really important. So this is what lupin looks like when it's ready to go. You're snapping that whole top of the pod off and tossing it into a bag. Similarly with New Jersey tea. And this is kind of the quantities we're talking about. So these are our seeding rates that we use for each species. 20 acres is a kind of a typical restoration that we do in any given year. So we're talking about significant quantities of seed. Lupin, 60 pounds of lupin seed sounds like a lot, and it is. But 2 pounds of 5 pounds of horse mint. Horse mint seed is like dust. It's like something like 2 million seeds per pound. So it's an enormous amount of effort to be able to collect these quantities. And then this is the other thing. So when you're collecting out there, you're not collecting pure seed. You're collecting seed and pods and water and all kinds of things. So these are the ratios here of what you collect to how much seed you get out of it. Lupin is really has really fleshy, wet pods, so that's why this one is so high. A lot of what you're collecting there is water weight. But lupin, you can collect 100 pounds as one person in a day if you're working hard. So it actually goes pretty quickly. But everything's different, but it's a significant quantity of material that you're collecting in order to get that amount of seed in. And again, this is what that looks like. This is what it looks like when it's on the plant. That's what it looks like when you've collected it, and then this is the pure seed. So the top is New Jersey tea, this is goat's rue, and this is butterfly milkweed. This coming season, we need to plant 78 acres of habitat. We kind of like went crazy, and we have tons and tons of land that needs to be planted. So these are the quantities that we need of these things. And luckily, I knew this last season. We're always planning at least a year in advance. So we worked really hard, and I'm happy to say that we got in everything. We didn't quite hit our goal on bush clover, but we hit our goal on lupin, New Jersey tea, and horse mint. But significant quantities of material, 6,500 pounds of pods is quite a bit. And it's in keeping meticulous data that I've been able to come up with these numbers, which have been really helpful. I always weigh everything as we collect it, and then I weigh it once it's dried, and then I weigh it once it's cleaned, and we keep track of how much time it takes. So we can start to like really plan for what we need going forward. This is kind of the numbers between 2009 and 2014. Seasonal employees are definitely doing the bulk of our seed collection out there. Temporary day labor, we hire temporary help only for lupin season, Lupin's kind of an interesting one in that there's a very limited window of time between when the seed is ripe enough to collect and then those pods explode and throw all their seeds out. So there's like this limited like week and a half to 2 weeks when we've got to collect that entire 6,500 pounds. So we'll use day labor for that. So that's where that number comes from. We don't use temp help for any other species, just for lupin. Volunteers are doing quite a bit out there. And then myself and other permanent staff are out there somewhat also. After seed's collected, you've got to dry it. So this is very low tech. We have a big barn. We lay it all out on the ground. We put a bunch of fans on it, and we just like leave it to dry. And then once it's dried, it gets bagged up into lawn and leaf bags, and then it gets forgotten about until winter. In winter, we do all of our seed cleaning. So you've got this huge amount of bulk, and it's not very functional. You know, you can 6,500 pounds of lupin seed will fill like 30 lawn and leaf bags. So it's not practical to use that material in planting. You couldn't do it. So what you need to do is clean that down to just the pure seed, to extract the pure seed from all of the other stuff. And this is an actual before and after. So this is what I brought to the seed cleaning facility, and this is what I ended up with. So it's quite a significant reduction. It's a little depressing when you look at it like this, but we work with the USDA Plant Material Center in Big Flats, New York. I bring all my restoration seed out there. Actually, everything except for lupin. Lupin goes to a DEC facility, the DEC Tree Nursery in Saratoga Springs, and they do all of our lupin seed cleaning for us, which is amazing because that's take me an enormous amount of time. But all the other species I bring out to this USDA Plant Material Center, where they have all kinds of equipment designed for seed cleaning. So when you're doing seed cleaning, the first thing you've got to do is break everything up. So you've got to release the seed from those pods somehow. The lupin throws it out on its own, but all the other things hang on to their seeds. So you've got to break it up. So there's different tools. This one is called a hammer mill. This cylinder rotates really fast, and these little pieces of metal fling out through centrifugal force. And it basically smashes everything up until it's small enough to fit through this curved screen. So obviously you make the whole size of that screen larger than your seed. So once your seeds are broken out, they and all of the rest of the material flows down through that seed, through that screen. This is called a brush machine. Similar concept, slightly different way of doing it. The material goes down into this hopper, ends up inside of this screen cylinder, and these brushes rotate and push it out through the screen. And then after you've done the breaking up, then you use a series of vibrating screens and air to separate the good seed from all of the other stuff. So there's different sizes. This is a little tabletop machine. This thing is like 2 stories tall. You have to load it from upstairs. And then this is kind of the medium-sized one. So you put a screen on the top that your seed, that's bigger than your seed, so your seed falls through that, and this separates all of the stuff that's too big, and it comes down this little chute, and you put a little bucket here to catch that, so that's waste. Then you've got a screen underneath this one that's smaller than your seed, so anything that's smaller than your seed falls through that, dirt and dust and sand and things, and that comes out of this chute here, and then the good seed and anything that's about the same size as the good seed falls down this chute here, which has a counter current of air blowing up. So the seed's is falling down, air is blowing up. It removes anything that's light that blows into this barrel here, and then the good seed comes out underneath. And it's loud. It's loud and it's dusty work, but it's kind of like magic because you start with all this huge stuff and you end up with this pure seed that looks so beautiful. That break it up and then screen it out thing sounds pretty straightforward. These are the actual data sheets for what we're like really doing. That's kind of like the broad strokes, but you're breaking it up multiple times and you're screening it out multiple times. And it's quite a bit more complicated than just that two-step process. But that's kind of the crux of what you're doing. So we've got this, we've got these intact ecosystems. We need to maintain them. This is kind of the final step here. And the primary way we do that is through fire. Whenever we can. This is a prescribed burn that we did last year. Fire is like the ultimate tool. It does everything we need it to do. And the plants are adapted specifically for fire. It's our best technique that does everything kind of all at once. But being where we are, we can't always burn everything that we want. You saw that map of development all around. You can't be smoking out the New York State Thruway or, you know, people's homes and businesses. So sometimes we've got to do other things. We do some mowing. This is a machine called a Fecon mower. It simulates the effects of the disturbance by just top-killing everything. It doesn't do any of the kind of the interesting chemistry that fire accomplishes, but I've got a little video of this in action, too. It's a pretty serious machine. And, of course, we've always got the invasive species spot treatment. So this looks very nice, nice intact ecosystem until you realize, boom, that there's black locust in there. So this is part of that invasive species prevention, ISPZs, and setting this up and kind of making sure you're always on top of even looking through your stuff that you think is in pretty good shape. Well, that's it. Any questions? Yeah.
So would this Albany pine bush... Albany pine bush, is this similar to like a scrubland, or is it a scrubland?
Scrubland, what do you mean, like, defined how?
So like Florida scrubland, it looks similar.
Yeah, yes. Yes, so yes, a scrubland or a barrens are kind of the most general terms that essentially means that overall structure of some kind of a sparse canopy, a well-developed shrub layer, and then a forb layer. So yeah, it is similar in that way. Yeah.
There seems to be a lot of chemicals used, like rid of all those different plants. Is there any concern with like how it affects wildlife at all? Because, you know, just chemicals everywhere.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, chemicals are like one of these things that are kind of a necessary evil. When you're managing land at the scale that we're managing at, it's the only practical way to do what we need to do. So, you know, if you read the labels on these things, they're supposed to theoretically not be harmful to wildlife. And because the habitat is so critically rare, we've decided that it's really important to maintain it and to restore it, even if it means that we have to use these chemical techniques. Yeah.
So what's the cost difference between girdling and herbicide and using herbicides?
That's a good question. You know, it would be, if we were hiring people to girdle, it would be like in the stratosphere as far as cost. Like when you, if you were to try to put a cost per acre, that's never been something we've even considered because it just wouldn't be practical. It wouldn't be financially, practical. So that's a technique that we use whenever we've got volunteers and when we want to engage the community, but it's not something that we would contract out.
You do more herbicide treatments than girdling. It just makes more sense that way?
More acreage-wise, yes. We probably spend more time girdling, but because it's so much less efficient, it's less acreage.
Yeah. Do you have people are allowed to go in there? Do you have like trails and stuff?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's 20 miles of trails throughout the preserve. There's 11 trailheads. We've got a discovery center, like an interpretive center that's free and open to the public. Yeah, trails are open 24/7, and the discovery center's 9 to 4 on weekdays and 10 to 4 on weekends. Yeah.
You mentioned you have other types of preserves on the Albany Pine Brush. What other type of reserves do you have for the
mountains? I'm not sure. Pine Brush is just one preserve.
Yeah, on your matrix when you're doing like the priorities.
Other community types?
All the community types.
Yeah, other community types. So things like forested wetlands, red maple hardwood swamp, ravine bottoms, things that they typically, any of the uplands we're going to try to restore to pine barrens. Anything that's wet is not restorable to pine barrens, never would have been that. So typically you're talking about wetlands.
Yeah, the pitch pine that you're removing, so is there a market value to that, or do you have to hire someone to?
It depends. The markets are always changing. A lot of times we can get work done at no cost. So the value of the timber basically pays for the labor. We are not able to make money on things. So even if there were to be a timber sale, that money would go to whoever the landowner is. The pine bush doesn't actually own the land. Owned by various municipalities, the state. There's almost never money coming in. I think maybe one time there was enough oak to bring money in, but that never comes to the preserve itself.
So to follow up on that, you mentioned something that's very just intriguing in the land ownership. So how does all the, what's the political?
Yeah. So it's complicated.
So the Albany Pine Bush Preserve Commission is a legislatively mandated commission where a public authority, so we're state employees as a public authority, and the commission is composed of all of the leaders of the municipalities, so City of Albany, County of Albany, Town of Guilderland, Town of Colony, the Nature Conservancy, and then there are Department of Environmental Conservation in New York State is the chair of the board. And then there are four citizen representatives appointed by the governor. So that is the commission. All of those commission members own the land that comprises the preserve. Those lands are dedicated to the preserve, which is a legal conveyance of management ability, essentially. So it's once land has been dedicated, it would take two acts of our state Congress to undedicate it. So it's pretty well locked away at that point. It's this patchwork of ownership, but because everything's been dedicated, we have similar, we manage it all as a contiguous piece. But we do run into sometimes with, if there are things that are grant funded that can't be used on state lands, we can use them on some of our other lands. So it does play a role sometimes, but it doesn't play a role day to day. But if you look at the map by ownership, it's kind of crazy.
I want to follow up on that too. So why was it never just carved away or decided as its own ownership thing?
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know. Yeah.
So what techniques were used to identify the history of vegetation in this area, and what was like the goal, the perfect landscape you guys were looking for, and like when, if ever in history, was that ever like that? Like when was it last like that?
Yeah. Those are all good questions. So, basically to try to figure it out, we went back to historic documentation, historic photographs, historic records of people talking about it, and not only from the Albany Pine Bush area, but also other Pine Barrens habitats that might have historical information. That happened, I was not a part of that process. That happened kind of before my time. I can't speak to specific methodologies, but I know that it was a lot of that kind of like literature review. What were the other parts?
What was like the perfect landscape you guys were reaching for, and was that ever, like, historically like that before, and when?
Right, okay. Yeah, so when the habitat was, I showed that picture of Glacial Lake Albany. When it was, like, tens of thousands of acres of barrens, that's when probably those ecological processes were there. You were getting more frequent fire, either through lightning strike and then also through native people. So it's a really productive ecosystem. There's tons of blueberries and huckleberries and like things you can eat out there, and lots of game is attracted because you've got that scrub oak's got tons of acorns. So it's thought that it's hard to pinpoint a time, because it may be one of these things that was always anthropogenically driven. There's, some people argue the kind of the lightning strike thing, but our habitat is different than the West, where you get these dry lightning situations. And there's probably some of that, but I think that native people probably always played a role in maintaining the barrens. As far as what we decided to was like kind of the perfect barrens, that's largely based on wildlife needs. So looking at historic records of like animals that were reported from here. You know, Carners are kind of like an easy one because, yeah, we want to like protect and encourage Carners. So you can see like what do Carners need? Like what kind of habitat do they need? And that's what skews us towards barrens versus thicket, for example. Because they need wild blue lupin. Wild blue lupin needs full sun. It's not going to grow in a thicket. So we're going to like focus on barrens for that. But there's lots of other things, bird species lists and invertebrate lists. This area is really rich in lepidopterans, and there's lots of good information, on what was kind of here historically. So by taking all of those, all of those things and piecing them together, we can figure out what kind of a habitat suits the most of these species that we're really interested in, and then kind of model our management work to create that.
I'm part of a group that's looking at the spread of hardy kiwi we're here in Pittsfield. Has that been a concern at all?
It's certainly on our watch list, but I've not seen it or heard of it anywhere like super close. All right. Well, thanks so much.